Okay, folks, this is Elvin Shamrock here again. I want to welcome you all to our teleconference. And as I begin always, is to share that because we have new people signing in all the time, the way this works is we have people that during the week have submitted some questions, concerns they have typically regarding cases on the case list. And I discuss them. I make sure they, although they are questions specific to these individuals, individual candidates, I try to make them relevant and pertinent to, and draw out the general points that are relevant to everyone listening in. So with that out the way, let's see if our active participants are with us. Maya, are you there, Maya? I don't hear Maya. What about Dana? Dana, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, welcome. Thank you so much. And Nikki, are you there? Nikki?
Yes, I'm here.
And
I'm here.
Thank you to you too as well for joining in and for volunteering. Hopefully Maya will join us as the session goes on. Dana, I have the email copy and pasted into an email that I got from my secretary, Karina. And so I got what your question is. But for the sake of everyone listening in, please go ahead and present your concern, and then we can talk about it.
Yeah, sure. I have a case that I was trying to figure out how to explain it on my board, but here's
mm-hmm.
the breakdown of it. I have a 20-year-old G2P1 at gestational age 39 weeks and 1 day who presented for Disney elective induction of labor at 39 weeks. As she progressed on to about 5 centimeters, decided to get an epidural. She did have some hypotension from the epidural, for which she received ephedrine, and the blood pressure stabilized. And sometime an hour later, she began having this shaky movement that became very rapid, and the nurse was concerned for seizure-like activity. She called a code blue. Everyone arrived to the scene, and per nursing report, it lasted about 10 seconds. Internal medicine showed up as well because it was a code blue that was called. At the end of this, the patient said that she couldn't remember anything that happened in those 10 seconds, but she did not know post-ictal state lasted longer than that. There was a question if this was a seizure or was this just a vasovagal episode. We consulted neurology, who thought the same. They couldn't rule out a seizure or a vasovagal episode, or was this even hypotension from the epidural still. We also consulted MFM, and since we couldn't rule out eclamptic seizure, we decided to treat it as such, started magnesium, got labs that were also normal. The patient herself was back to baseline. We proceeded with the induction of labor, and she went on to have an uncomplicated vaginal delivery. Her postpartum period was completely uncomplicated. Neurology, who we had consulted, decided to get an MRI that was normal. They even decided to do EEG, was also normal. And she eventually went home on postpartum day two.
And I'm assuming the reason why you've brought this case to our attention is because you're left with a potentially major diagnosis, but
yes.
You're really not sure what it is. Am I
yes,
correct?
Yes, exactly. Yes, I had
okay.
low suspicion of eclampsia. Her blood pressures were normal. I believe she had one, if I remember correctly, one maybe a reflexive it was like a 140s systolic blood pressure after all the ephedrine. But this was well before this episode. But otherwise, her blood pressures were normal besides the hypotension from the epidural.
Sure.
But I had to treat it as an eclampsia because I couldn't exactly rule out in a moment.
Correct. So look, let me give you the short answer, and then for your sake, as well as everyone listening in, I want to dissect it out a little bit, because there is a very important issue that can be learned from this kind of a case. Number one, the way you presented was very good.
Oh, thank you.
because you said what made it very good. You were open and honest. You said, you know, I really didn't think it was preeclampsia. I was thinking it might be this, it might be that. But at the end of the day, I called in this person, I called in that person. We did these tests, and I gave magnesium sulfate just on the off chance that it was eclampsia, but I don't know. And I would add, and I think we will never know. It's okay to say that, mm-hmm. you know. That's how I would phrase it, but it's very close to how you phrased it in your presentation. So I think the presentation was very good. And so for everyone listening in, the point that I want you folks to take home, you don't have to know, it sounds terrible, but you don't have to know what's going on all the time. There are obviously going to be times, many of you have experienced them up until now, and you certainly all will as you go along your careers, where you don't know what you're dealing with. And that's okay. And as long as you have an approach that, A, will probably, well, not always, but probably get you to a diagnosis, and B, you'll keep the patient safe. So with that understanding, that it's okay to say in the exam, you know, I really wasn't sure what we were dealing with at the time. In fact, I'm still not. Be open and honest. You come across as sincere, and you're building up your examiner-candidate relationship. They see that you've got integrity, and that's a very positive character trait that you can exude in an exam. Mm-hmm.
What questions do you see me getting from this? I wonder. Too.
Say again. I didn't hear you. Say again.
I feel this is a minefield of questions that could be asked.
So that's the second point I wanted to come to.
Sure.
I've shared with you the approach of how to present. But now, after you've presented, now they're going to want to come with questions. And I can almost guarantee that they want to know, what did you think of in your differential diagnosis and why? And how did you go about ruling them in or out? So when you've got, and this goes to everyone listening in, when you've got a case and you're not quite sure what you're dealing with, present it exactly that way. Be totally honest. But when it comes to questions, be prepared for questions on the differential and how you ruled it in or out, because that's where the conversation is going to go. It's the logical place for it to go. And what did you do? And what you did for her has to show that you did whatever was the best thing for the patient's outcome. And even if she didn't have eclampsia, and it seems, based on what you told us, that it's unlikely she did, to give a MAG, give you still a reasonable and appropriate therapy. Because I think you did great. And I would even go so far at the end of the conversation and say, you know, to this day, I'm not sure exactly what it was. But I've thought about this case, obviously, many times over and over, and I've come to the conclusion that if I were presented with the same kind of case tomorrow, I would treat her exactly the same way. And if you say that, it's a very powerful statement, because it's telling the examiner, obviously, you only say this if you genuinely believe it, but you're telling the examiner, what I did was the right thing, it was standard of care, and it was appropriate. So be comfortable to say these things. You know, I would do it again. I feel it was the right approach. So my response to you, Dana, does that answer the question? You got to work out what is the differential. How do you distinguish between a seizure of eclampsia, hypotension related possibly to the epidural, hysteria? I'm not sure what an epileptic seizure. How would each of these be distinguished one from the other? And show the examiner you thought about all of these things. Are you comfortable with the response? Do you understand the approach that I'm sharing with you, Dana?
Yes, I do.
Do you have any questions?
I know I got a bunch of labs besides the health labs. I forgot to mention I got a lactic acid, and that was normal. I figured that would be abnormal if she actually had some type of actual seizure. And I did get an EKG. I forgot to mention that, so I should probably put that in there. That was fine as well.
Well, you know, just understand to you, Dan, as well as everyone listening in, think about what you want to say in your presentation and what you want to hold back for the question and answer time. Because if you give everything in your presentation, A, you've left them nothing to ask you. The conversation becomes a lot shorter. And also, if you say X as part of your presentation versus response to a question, it's more impressive in the examiner's mind if you say it in response to their question rather than you just presenting it. Because if it's a response to a question, they're thinking, well, she didn't know I was going to ask this, and she still got it right. She answered decently. So you score more. So give what you feel is necessary for the presentation, but don't give away the whole store. Keep some back. Now, what I'm suggesting, you've got to practice this. It's not going to come easy to you. You got to practice this, and the way to do it is just practice talking, I will be, and my whole team will be sharing with you the need as you go into the next several months after cases construction, the need to practice talking and have as much mock oral exposure as you can, and this issue that we've just been talking about is one of multitudes of issues that you should try and practice on those cases where it's appropriate. So Dana, again, any questions on your end, or can we move on? It's up to you. You're good
that's
with what
fine.
You
no, thank you. Yeah,
okay,
I guess my only one question is, I realized when I was talking to you, I did leave off things like I got EKG, I got a lactic acid. Is that what you meant? That I can leave out and maybe they
totally
might ask me for additional workup?
I'm happy you left it off. You want to be as brief as you can, even to the point sometimes of being cryptic, because it's in being a little cryptic and not giving it all out, you're piquing your examiner's curiosity. And it's from that curiosity that's going to generate your next question. And so if you've held it back, you've got it ready should they ask you that question. So I think the way you presented initially was really nice, and you didn't give too much. If you would have started giving the labs, there's probably no end to what the labs were. And I'd want to know what a hemoglobin is. Maybe she was anemic and on that basis had a seizure. You know, it can go on and on. Once you get into that realm, the ability to give a succinct presentation becomes very tough.
Sure. Okay. No, that was helpful.
All right.
Thank
so you're okay with this case then?
Yes. Thank you.
Perfect. Good, good, good. All right. Nikki, you're up next. Are you there, Nikki?
Yes. Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay. Now, let me get your screenshot that you sent in the email. I've got it in front of me. Great. Okay, go ahead and I've got it in front of me, but go ahead and present the case to everyone listening in.
Okay. This is a 49-year-old P1. She was referred, this is on my guide list, a 49-year-old P1 referred by an outside clinic for abnormal uterine bleeding that failed multiple medical management strategies, including an IUD. When she came to me, her EMB was benign. Her ultrasound showed a uterus measuring 12 centimeters and a fibroid measuring 6 centimeters. However, it was really difficult to see the IUD in her uterus, so a follow-up x-ray showed an IUD was present in the pelvis, so the surgical plan was for a TLH bilateral self-injectomy and removal of an IUD. Because she got COVID, her surgery was delayed about 3 months, so ultimately when she had her surgery, her exam significantly changed intraoperatively. She had a very large prolapsing fibroid. She had a duplicated right ureter and a bicornuate uterus, in fact. So her hysterectomy was complicated by a bladder injury, which was identified intraoperatively and repaired. Final pathology showed a uterus measuring or weighing 653 grams. A leiomyoma, which was 11 centimeters, that filled and dilated the endometrial canal, benign endometrium, and a benign cervix and fallopian tube.
And
I'm just going to stop there.
Say again, through the last bit?
I was going to stop there.
Okay. I'm guessing you're pained by the fact that you had a cystotomy, and how are you going to handle this? Is that the issue?
Yes, I'm pained by the cystotomy. I'm pained by the change in the exam because I think that would have changed my preoperative planning and, in terms of maybe additional imaging. I'm kind of kicking myself that I didn't
get a reading or something
in that timing.
Are you upset that the diagnosis changed from a fibroid uterus to a prolapsing fibroid? Is that what's bothering you?
Yeah. So what the backstory is that I suspect that since the fibroid was dilating her cervix so much that it was hard for us to put in the manipulator during the case. And so what we kind of ended up doing was almost like a cerclage just to keep the manipulator in place. Retrospectively, we think that maybe that distorted somehow her anatomy. Her anatomy was already pretty distorted and interesting, but maybe doing that kind of stitching maybe distorted it more and maybe made the bladder a little bit closer to the cervicovaginal junction than we had thought. That's kind of what my thought was. So I'm kind of kicking myself that I maybe didn't do like cephalopron ahead of time to maybe shrink it a little bit more, just kind of things I could have done to prevent it.
Okay. So this is the kind of case that's frustrating as having practice, but it's great from the exam point of view. Just I want to share with you an experience of mine. When I was a fourth-year resident, a co-resident of mine had a similar case to this. She saw her in the clinic for a pre-op visit, exactly the same case as what you presented, with a fibroid uterus. And a large fibroid. Everything's fine, ready for surgery. She arrived 2 days later for her surgery, and as part of the pre-op examination, she does a pelvic exam, and she finds a prolapsing fibroid. The attending said, we've got to cover with antibiotics as a consequence of this. And the attending also recommended they should delay the surgery 2 weeks, give the antibiotics to take an effect. I'm not going to get into whether that was the correct decision or not. The point that I want to make is a fibroid can prolapse any time, and this could have happened over a 24-hour period. That's number one. Just by the way, it was a little humorous because she was at the end of her GYN rotation, and delaying this case meant that she lost the case. and co-resident who came in after her picked it up. So she was a little bitter and twisted about that. But we all want to do surgery as much as we can for education purposes, and she lost this one. It was unfortunate. There's one other thing that you mentioned. You said there was a bicornuate uterus. Just understand, and I don't know how many of you listening in might have picked this up, but in the exam, I think it's nice to say this because it shows the examiner you're really thinking about your cases. If this fibroid is even mildly pedunculated and attached from the fundus, as it prolapses down the cervical canal, it's going to create a dimpling on the fundus, pulling down its base. And so what you've described as a bicornuate uterus might be secondary to the pedunculated fibroid prolapsing down the cervix. Does that make sense to you?
It does. Additionally,
now, I might be wrong. It might be a genuine bicornuate. But I want you to say in the exam, you know, I was wondering whether or not this was a genuine bicornuate or it could – I want you to think aloud is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. You're
going to
say something?
I was going to say her IUD was in one of the horns. So I'm the IUD wasn't seen preoperatively on the ultrasound. It was seen on the X-ray, but it was in one of the horns. I think it wasn't tucked in.
It was pushed. It can be pushed there by the fiber. Not surprised, actually. That's quite sensible. Look. This case is great, and the primary reason why it's great is because it was, in retrospect, a potential setup for bladder or ureteric injury, and you did. Mm-hmm. You got a cystotomy. So this is a case waiting for a discussion on the course of the ureter,
mm-hmm.
what precautions might you have taken in a case like this? And I would say you might want to consider putting in stents or doing a preoperative IVP to see where those ureters are. And then it's a discussion on cystotomy.
Mm-hmm.
Now with respect to cystotomy, again, none of us like to have a cystotomy in practice, but it's great from the exam point of view. And folks, those of you who have cystotomy or enterotomy in your cases, fantastic. For those of you who don't, you've still got 2 weeks of cases collection. You never know, okay? So you still have a chance. Not that I'm suggesting you go in and stab the bowel or bladder. But if you don't, at the end of cases collection, have a enterotomy or a cystotomy, you can still be asked these questions as a structured case of the day. So whether you've got it on your cases or not, you need to know this. That's the bottom line, okay? Where's the conversation going to go? What questions are they going to ask you? Number one, when in the procedure did you notice the cystotomy? Number two, did it happen at that point or did it happen sometime prior to the point when you noticed it? And when do you believe it might have occurred and why? It's very practical, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of techniques can we employ to reduce the risk of a cystotomy or a ureteric injury? And then when it comes to closure, did you do the hysterectomy first and then the cystotomy repair or vice versa? And why? What was your reasoning? And this is a very important question, where was the cystotomy in relation to the trigone? Because if it's affecting the trigone, we really need to get urology or urogyn to come in and repair it if we possibly can. But anywhere else, we certainly can do it if local experts are not available. Now, with respect to that repair, even if you call it urology, you've got to be able to answer. If urology wasn't available, what would you do? And here, you've got to talk about how many layers would you close in? And there's some textbooks that say 3 layers. And, you know, the bladder is so paper thin, I don't know how you can get 3 layers, to be quite honest. So if you want to say 2 layers, that's absolutely fine. But say what those layers comprise, muscular layer and imbricating stitch, perhaps, layer. What suture material did you use and why? You folks have to know the basics of suture, you know, which are permanent, which are not permanent, how long do they maintain their tensile strength, etc. And what stitch type did you use and why? Was it interrupted, continuous, locking, non-locking? What did you use? Then you've got to be able to talk about post-operative bladder drainage and catheter management, the need potentially for antibiotics. And that's where this conversation will go. They may also ask you, should you have considered, you mentioned it in your presentation, should you have considered preoperative Depo-Lupron? So be prepared for a brief conversation on that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But this case is a great case. I think you did, and it's for any complication that you folks have. Be open and honest about it. This complication arose in retrospect because of X, Y, Z. And then you finish off, you say, and this is a general principle for all complications, where it's appropriate, obviously, you say, you know, as a consequence of this case, I now do things a little bit differently. When I get a really large uterus due to fibroids, and I'm concerned that anatomy might be distorted, I now get an IVP or I place stents intraoperatively, just so I can pluck the ureters with a blunt probe. I know exactly where they are, and I can stay clear of them. Sound reasonable? You want to show the examiner.
Yeah.
You're always learning. And, yeah, we can all get complications. But when we get them, we take what mm-hmm. we can from a positive, constructive point of view and include it into our practice, which makes us better and safer doctors as we go along. So would you be comfortable with that kind of approach?
Nikki? Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any questions about this?
Do you feel like looking at what I submitted that it's overall the correct level of detail, or should I?
Okay, so I'm one question that they may ask you is, how did you do the endometrial biopsy? Because at that point it wasn't prolapsing; it was probably occupying the cavity of the uterus. Which might have compromised your endometrial biopsy. They may ask you, what would you have done if you got an inadequate sample?
Mm-hmm.
So just have a response for that.
Okay.
Nick, you said something in our discussion afterwards which reminded me, and I want to bring it up because it's really important for every single one of you. You mentioned something about, I did an ultrasound or I should have done, or I didn't, or you did do an ultrasound. The point that it was reminding me of in GYN particularly, the observational, let's call it, the study of choice is an ultrasound. It's not a CT scan, it's not an MRI, it's not an IVP. The modality of choice is an ultrasound. And when you do an ultrasound, as with any test, you've got to have a specific reason for it. Don't just do an ultrasound to cover your backside, you know, call your medicine. Have a specific reason. Because otherwise it looks like you're not confident in what you're doing. So if you get a good pelvic exam in a thin patient and you're comfortable that you felt what you felt and you didn't miss anything, you might be hard-pressed to explain why you did an ultrasound. So every ultrasound you folks have on your case list, please make sure that there's a reason why it was necessary. And if some of you are going to find, wow, why the hell did I do that ultrasound? It wasn't really that necessary. You can always say the patient was a little overweight and it compromised the exam. That's an easy way to get out of it. But I just want you to be aware, the take-home message, do whatever study you want, but make sure there's a valid reason indication for it. Okay, Nikki, anything else on your side regarding this case?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, you're comfortable with it?
Yes.
Good, excellent. Okay, let me go back to my email. Bear with me 1 second, folks. Here it is. Okay. Let's see. Our third candidate, Maya. Maya, are you there by any chance? Maya?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, welcome. Thank you. You got on a little late, so I missed you in the beginning. But thank you for joining us. It's good to have you. And I have your list in front of me, your case, I should say. I want you to present to everyone listening in to explain what is the issue that you've got, and then we can discuss it.
Yes. So I had the first case is a 46-year-old. She's a G1P1, and she came into my clinic for vaginal bulge symptoms, she was noted to have a uterine prolapse on my exam. Her ultrasound did show a fibrouterus, and so my treatment plan is to have a planned hysterectomy with Urogyn. Now, my main question was, this patient does have a history of Crohn's disease, and she's a G1P1 with bulge symptoms, so I think that's the reason why she has the bulge symptoms. But I didn't know if I should put Crohn's disease specifically in this case, because I didn't know if I did, would that be what the examiner focuses in on?
Okay, so it's a very tenuous issue, case, but it's a very relevant issue. Look, many of you have heard me talk about reverse engineering, and this is a classical example of that. The question, Maya, is, do you want to talk about Crohn's disease or not? Or would, you know, is it just not your comfort level?
It's not my comfort level.
Okay, so you don't want to. Is the fact that she's Crohn's relevant to the case in a major way?
No, it would only be the reason why she had the urine prolapse with only one pregnancy, with one delivery history.
Okay. Well, the point that I make is, when you think of, this was prolapse and AUB, I think you said, yes? Did she have AUB?
She just had vaginal bulge symptoms and had a fibroid on ultrasound.
Okay. So your fibroid uterus falling down the vagina, How relevant is Crohn's to that? Really, it's not part of the conversation.
Okay.
So I would say to you and anyone else listening in, if you had a, and most of us don't, but if you have a comfort level to talk about Crohn's, then put it in, sure. And you can even maximize it. Concern for complicating factor of Crohn's, because the examiner would have to ask you, why were you, what was the complicating factor? Why is Crohn's a complicating factor? But if you don't want to talk about it, just leave it off completely. It's not that critical. You don't have to put all the, what I call, non-essential information down. It's your choice. So if you don't want to talk about it, I would leave it off. That's the short answer. Okay? Good. What else?
Yes. I know I gave you a second case, but I actually was hoping to talk about a different case.
Go ahead. Sure. Present it to a four so all of us can know what you're talking about.
Perfect. So I have a patient who is 30 years, through the 30-year-old G0 with a history of morbid obesity and who came in to clinic complaining of irregular cycles. She had progressively been gaining weight, and as she continued to gain weight, her cycles became more and more infrequent. And so because of the weight gain and this chronic history of anovulation, before I wanted to do treatment with possible hormonal OCTs, I wanted to do a little bit of more of an investigation with a biopsy to ensure there was no hyperplasia or malignancy going on.
You're talking about an endometrial biopsy, yes?
Yes, endometrial biopsy, yes.
Okay. And she's, how old did you say? 30 years old?
30 years old, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The patient was very apprehensive, very strongly declined wanting to do an in-office endometrial biopsy, and she preferred, if we needed to do the sampling, to undergo general anesthesia. And so I ended up doing an operative hysteroscopy on her. The hysteroscopy returned with proliferative endometrium, and we discussed birth control options afterwards, and she opted for birth control pills, which she has been on. I guess my main question is, would the examiners have a big problem with me doing an operative hysteroscopy of somebody with just anovulation as a reasoning?
Okay, so it brings up some beautiful issues for everyone. This is not a problem, but it is an issue. And 99.9% of your questions, you all say to me at the course and on the teleseminar, I've got this problem. It's not a problem. It's an issue. You just need to know how to deal with it. And this is one of them. number one, you're doing an endometrial biopsy in a woman under age 45, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that indicated?
It is because of the obesity.
Correct. Perfect. So you, in the conversation, you want to shine, and you say, normally I wouldn't do this. It's not indicated in a 30-year-old, but given the fact that she had morbid obesity or increasing obesity and with consequent increased estrogen exposure because of peripheral conversion, her risk for endometrial hyperplasia and possibly adenocarcinoma was increased, and for that reason, I felt it was appropriate. So you went ahead and counseled her on an endometrial biopsy,
mm-hmm.
and she declined. And so now you went ahead and did a hysteroscopy. And folks, I'm sure half the people listening in have this issue as well. The mere fact that you folks are posing the question to me and you're worried about it, in and of itself indicates you're not comfortable to defend the case because you feel it might be construed as possibly on the edge, reaching standard of care. I'm going to role play your situation, Maya, and I want you to imagine you're the examiner. You're hearing me present this issue. I want you to tell me how it sounds to you. I would say, you know, in this particular case, I decided to sample the endometrium because of their obesity. But when I counseled her, she was a super anxious patient, and she didn't want to have done any procedure in the office. And as a consequence, I'm moving to the next best thing, discussing the possibility of a DNC or hysteroscopy, and I landed up doing hysteroscopy, which came back negative. Now this is the part I want you all to listen to. I've since thought back about this case, because I wasn't 100% comfortable in retrospect about doing a hysteroscopy on a 30-year-old patient. And whereas the advantage, the risk benefit ratio in a 30-year-old for an endometrial biopsy is in favor of doing the procedure, what I've come to feel is that the risk benefit ratio is not in favor in a 30-year-old when it comes to hysteroscopy, because although hysteroscopy is still a very simple, straightforward, benign procedure, there's still potential anesthesia involved, and it's a bigger procedure, more cost, and I'm not sure the risk-benefit ratio is in favor of doing this. And so, and here you can go either way, Maya. I'm just going to take my position, okay? Mm-hmm. As a consequence, I'm going to do exactly what I said 5-10 minutes ago. As a consequence of this case, and after giving it considerable thought, I think if I was to be presented with this case again, I would strongly encourage the office biopsy, but I wouldn't take her to the OR. I don't think the risk benefit is warranted, and I would counsel her to watch out for not decreasing menses, but increasing abnormal uterine bleeding, increased bleeding, heavy periods, which would be more concerning. And I might start off with an ultrasound, but that's not all that reliable in a premenopausal patient, and it's not all that reliable in a patient who's known to have large fibroids in the cavity. How does that response sound to you, Maya?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Would you be comfortable to adopt that?
Yes.
So, folks, the point I'm trying to make is you can even take a situation where, in retrospect, you wish you had done it a little differently. And in this case, it's not the end of the world, by the way. I'm being honest. I would not have treated this patient this way. But I'm not saying what Maya did was wrong. It's a different approach. But the point is, regardless of whether you're on my side or Maya's side, that's irrelevant. If you're in a situation where you feel that the management that you did meet out was not the optimal, say it in the exam. You know, after much consideration, I wouldn't treat this patient the same way. I would do it a little differently. I would do the following, A, B, C, D, E. And you come across so strong because you're showing the examiner, you really think about every case, not only as you're doing it, but also after you're doing it, you think back, did I treat this patient in the most efficacious way possible? And can I learn from this case? And I'm making myself a better physician all the time as I go along in my career. That's a very comforting notion for an examiner to receive about a candidate. So the common theme of today's session, and to really all intents and purposes, all the sessions that I conduct with you folks, just be open and honest with your examiner. It's that you come across the best way possible. So I would have done it differently. I'm not saying I am right and you are wrong. But what I am saying is there's a way to present this. And your examiner may believe in your approach, may believe in my approach. But if you give the kind of presentation that I gave, however they believe, they will be comforted that you're safe and you're doing things okay. I'm not saying you're not safe. I don't want you to put down the phone at the end of this conference and jump out of a building. I'm not saying that at all. Please understand. I would do it differently, okay? That's all I'm saying, okay? But did you understand the philosophy that I'm trying to get across here?
Yes.
Okay. Did it sound reasonable? Did it sound good to you?
Yes, so after, if they ask me to present the case and I present it, should I automatically say, like, in retrospect, you know, and say that I would maybe consider a different approach, or should I just wait for them to...
That's a great question. Great, great question. And my response is very universal to a lot of cases with complications. If they were to ask me, present this case, I would start by saying, you know, this was a very interesting case because as a result of this case, I've changed my management ever so slightly. You give that introduction sentence. Now you've got them in your grasp and they want to know what's happened here. And then you go and present the case. Does that make sense to you? So you're not hiding anything. You're telling them up front, there was something interesting that happened, and I learned from it. Did I hurt anyone in the process? No. But I'm arguing. People would argue with me as well. But I'm arguing I'm a better physician for having changed. You can argue and do whatever you want in practice, okay? But I'm just sharing with you how to handle it in the exam.
Okay.
So does that answer your question? How to present the case? You bring the complication up front. Some of you, let's think of the worst possible complication. Heaven forbid it happens to you, but it does happen. A maternal death. You've got a maternal death on your case list. How do you handle it? The guy says, present case number 15. You say your opening sentence in the presentation is, you know, as you'll see, this was a most tragic case because the patient died. What it turned out was she was a 28-year-old gravid, a 3-peritoneum who presented at X weeks, and you go ahead and present. But the point that I'm making, I want every one of you, it's part of oral exam technique. Don't be shy to talk about complications. Just be open and honest about them and acknowledge them. And most importantly, show how you deal with them. And so here you have a maternal death. The first words out of my mouth are, this was a tragic case because you will notice the patient died. And then I go on to present. Does it make sense to you, Maya?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions?
Not on this case. I did have one other question just in general.
Okay, just take a quick question. Go ahead.
Okay, for the OB side, I have a lot of patients who are advanced maternal age, but I don't know if it's a good idea to write that on every single one of my cases because there are some other things that I want to focus in on.
Correct.
So it's okay to omit that.
So the short answer is yes, but let me give you a little bit more background. Let's say you've got 50 cases on your OB list, and 25 of them are over age 35. Or 30 of them. If you put AMA on every single one of those, number one, you flood your cases with AMA, And it makes it very difficult for the examiner to dig between it to find the real juicy stuff. So I encourage you not to do that. So what I would do, you do want to have the potential to have an AMA conversation in your exam because it's easy. Mm-hmm. So what I would do, I would only put AMA on those patients who, let's say, were 40 and over. Because now, instead of having 25, 30 cases, you may have five. Also, if you put AMA on every single case, and the patient also happens to have some other much, much more interesting thing, you don't waste the space, so to speak, talking about mundane stuff when there's really interesting stuff to discuss. So don't put it down on all of them. And if the examiner turns around to you, I see you called this 41-year-old AMA, but the patient before is 39. You didn't put on AMA. Is she not AMA? How do you respond? You understand my question. They're going to say you're being inconsistent. So the response then is, Dr. Examiner, you're exactly correct. If you have a look, about 50% of my patient population is AMA. And rather than put it down on every other case on my case list, because it would have become burdensome to read the case list, I just put it on the more extreme cases of 40 and up. And you're not trying to hide anything. They're going to be appreciative more than anything else. Okay?
Okay, perfect.
All right,
yep.
Good. I just want to go back for a second, folks. We were speaking about endometrial biopsies and endometrial hyperplasia. I may have mentioned it last session or two sessions ago, I can't recall. But in the most recent list of MOC articles that we had to read, there was one article on endometrial carcinoma and a second article on endometrial hyperplasia. Both review articles, both were very good. And if ABOG feels that they want every practicing OBGYN to read these articles, it's not a bad idea that you should be familiar with them. Now, I may have mentioned this before. We know that pretty much every single one of you are going to come to our definitive board prep course. We're waiting for a potential. We got a list in January, we got a list in May, and there's potentially a third list coming out in August. Once we know whether or not there's a third list and it's been issued, or if it hasn't been issued, that we've got the entire list already, we will send out to all our attendees, a list of those articles. You need to just go through the title and see, are you comfortable to talk about anything in that title? And if you've got a case on your case list where that article may have some bearing on the case and may come up as part of a discussion, then it's not a bad idea just to be briefly familiar with the findings. I'm not saying you've got to go and pull 45 articles, okay? That's not what I'm suggesting. But it's worth on spending 5 minutes going through the list and seeing, are there any articles that you do want to read a little bit more in detail. We will have summaries, if some of you are interested, for you later on in the year to help you with getting familiar with these things in a short period of time. But at this point in time, just know that we've got you covered. We will give you a list of the MOC articles once we know we've got the complete list for the year. And I just wanted to share that in this year, regardless if you've got a case on your case list or not, but endometrial hyperplasia and endometrial carcinoma, obviously ABOC thinks it's pretty relevant, pretty important. Okay, that was one I wanted to share with you. The other thing is, if any of you have not yet signed up, our Zoom course for the year, Definitive Board Prep course, starts today 1 week, next week Sunday. We're going to have our Zoom course, and if you're interested and you haven't yet signed up, obviously do so. And then I think we start off in Baltimore, not Los Angeles, I'm not sure, but I think it's Baltimore in August. We will do our live courses or our hybrid courses. The first 2 days are done online for the hybrid, and the last 4 days are done live. The Zoom course, obviously, all 6 days will be done online. All right. Maya, very briefly, did you find the session helpful?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Would you recommend others to volunteer? And you can say it's a waste of time or don't do it. He's terrible. I've got broad shoulders. I don't mind.
No, absolutely. It's good.
Okay, good. Thank you so much. Dana, how about you? I think we may have lost Dana.
Yes, no, I'm here. I just had to unmute my phone. Yeah, I found it very helpful. Thank you.
All right, good. I'm pleased. And Nikki, how about you?
Yes, super helpful. Thanks so much.
All right, sure. I'm looking here, and it says on my sheet, the next teleseminar is the 9th of July. Now, that is three weeks away. Usually we do them every 2 weeks. My secretary virtually never, ever, ever makes a mistake. I'm very fortunate to work with some really fine people. So I'm going to tell you what she wrote. Is the next teleseminar is the 9th of July. If this is wrong, we'll send out an email just to correct it. But she's never wrong, so I guess it's the 9th of July. All right, folks, thank you so much. We'll do this again in 3 weeks' time, and all the best. Please tell your friends to come and join us. And it's free. It's always a good idea to go for anything that's free. Although Milton Friedman used to say there's no such thing as a free lunch, and he's correct, but that's another conversation. Folks, love to have you and your colleagues back next time. All the best of luck. We'll be in touch. Bye-bye.